Hello and welcome to In Person with Paul on Crime Time FM. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And here I interview authors about their new novels. My guest today is debut author Jack Lutz. His London murder mystery, set in a dystopian near future London, London in Black, is inventive, pacey and thrilling. It's an alt reality that also reflects on the history and culture of the city. I spoke to London-based Jack while he was away in the States, and his mum's cat slips occasionally into the interview, clearly a fan of dystopian fiction. Anyway, without further ado, let's hear what Jack and the cat have to say about London in Black. Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM, Jack.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You too, sir?
Yeah, doing very well, thanks.
Great, okay. Well, let's hear about that then. Then let's see about London in Black. And it's just been published. So what's it been like as a debut published author?
Oh, it's been great. It's been a bit surreal. But, I mean, it's quite literally a dream come true, right? To walk around bookshops. And, you know, I've had those dreams, walking around saying, it would be amazing to have your book on the shelves. And there it is. It's actually there. So it's literally a dream come true. It's quite surreal. It's really fun. It's really fun.
Good, because that's what it's supposed to be. And of course, it's been a bit more difficult for some people with COVID recently. But
oh gosh, yeah, yeah. I'm very, very lucky. I think just all the launch events and things have been pretty normal. And I can only imagine a year ago, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, it would have been completely different. But for me, it was great. I got to go into, you know, bookshop and do things there, and it was fun.
Good. No, I'm really pleased to hear that. Tell us a little bit about yourself then, because you're a lawyer. And did you always want to be a writer?
I think so. I mean, I think the first thing I wrote, I've got a story. I was just digging through some containers here at my mother's, and I pulled out a short story I'd written when I was maybe 8 or 7.
Right.
And it was like a little crime story, and it was set in London. And so I guess that's just what I'd always wanted to be. And I sort of went to school, and then I went to law school. And I mean, I do love being a lawyer, but you know, but even when I was going through school, there was this piece of my brain that said, I just really connect being a writer. It's what I really, really love. So.
Right. So this is a dream come true.
As you said.
What did you like reading then when you were younger?
So when I was really young, I read Agatha Christie, honestly.
Right.
I mean, I read like every Agatha that exists probably.
So a proper crime fan from early on.
Yeah. But it was really interesting. I mean, I liked the crime, but I just liked the world. I mean, for me, it was a very different world and I just loved it. But yeah, a lot of Agatha Christie, honestly, from very early on was the diet.
It's interesting you say about the world, because obviously the world is very important in the context of your novel, and we'll get to that. In fact, it's probably a good idea to give people a flavor of London in Black now. Tell us a little bit about the plot and the storyline.
Sure. So it's set in London in 2029. And in London in 2029, terrorists are using a new nerve agent called London Black to terrorize the city. And there's a scientist who's killed. And the cop who's investigating, her name is Lucy Stone, thinks that he developed a new antidote for this nerve agent, which she needs because the drugs that she's using for protection aren't working for her anymore. And so she's got to sort of chase the killer and hunt this antidote before her drugs stop working entirely.
Yeah, that's a perfect summary. And we're going to kind of talk around the plot because we don't want to be telling people too much. It's a book where you want to discover these things for yourself, isn't it, really? So before we talk about the book itself, though, let's talk about some of the backstory, because I think there's some fascinating things in this. Is it right that this idea came to you while you were on the tube?
It did. It came to me while I was on the tube in 2019, actually. And it wasn't even so much that the idea for the plot came to me. What really, really came to me was this character, this
right.
cop.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So it was sort of like, you know, it was like she tapped me on the shoulder sort of and was like, here I am, write me. And I think in the story, she's quite aggressive in her personality and she comes across that way, hopefully. But that's what it felt like to me. It was just, you know, here I am. And so the first thing I really did was I did like a like a backstory exercise where I went and had, you know, did like a sort of character interview. And it was just, I mean, I think I wrote like 6,000 words in a day or something. And it was just like, just tumbling out. This character just came out of nowhere. And then I had to sort of craft the story around her.
Right. Okay. Well, let's start. I was going to go for other details first, actually.
So I thought you'd say the idea of the attack and the dystopian world was what came to you.
But let's go with Lucy then, now you've mentioned her, because she's the driver of the whole novel. So let's talk about Lucy. Tell us a little bit about her. I mean, she is very driven. You indicated that.
She is very driven. I think she's, you know, it's funny. I feel incredibly badly for Lucy because she's just had a tough run since she was little. Her mother died when she was really young, or, you know, all sorts of things happened to her. But at the same time, she's just super dogged. And so she just keeps going all the time and just takes a hit and just gets back up and just keeps going.
Yeah, I got that. You know what? The self-reliance thing, she's very self-reliant, but of course she's had problems with her brother and her lover and her father. And all these things have happened. And we get to know this through the backstory. And this makes her an incredibly self-reliant person. But she also has what normally we'd know as survivor guilt. But there's a little extra edge to it here. Tell us a little bit about the debt.
Yeah, so it's really, it's interesting, and I don't want to give too much away, but...
Yeah, sure.
She's coming out of a London that has been, you know, terrorized. And so she's walking around
right.
in a culture that's filled with survivor guilt, which really is of course a form of PTSD. And so she's struggling with that mightily for a whole bunch of different reasons. And some may be expected and some may be unexpected, but she's essentially got really, really severe PTSD and she feels an incredible amount of guilt as a result, and she's resisting therapy. And so, you know, when the novel starts off, she's alone in this flat. She's painted everything black. She can't sleep. She has these horrible nightmares. She's removed the bed because she doesn't want to fall asleep. If she falls asleep, she'll scream herself awake. So she's just sort of crippled by this guilt. And I thought it was interesting to put a character who's dealing with survivor's guilt, which of course, you know, isn't really a moral guilt.
Absolutely.
You know, but I thought having a character,
nonetheless, it's something that's so ingrained in her character.
Yeah. And I thought that having that in a crime novel, which is always a question of guilt at some level, sort of who did it and why, might be interesting. And so, you know, that theme of guilt I tried to have run throughout the book. So all the different characters are sort of grappling with some guilt at some level. But Lucy's is really overriding. And for her, she's got this sort of formula in her head where she feels like she's done something terrible. She feels like she's got some debt and she's got to pay it off. And the only way she knows how to pay it off is to work. And you know, if she would go to therapy, she could work through that, but she's resisting therapy. And so it's this terrible cycle for her that she can't seem to break.
And all of that gets thrown into her work.
Exactly. And so I think it's, you know, and I think that what happens quite early on in this book is she seizes on this stolen antidote that she thinks there's an antidote. It's unclear whether there is. And for her, that might be a way to finally feel like she's paid this debt and she's over the guilt. And if she does that, she can go to therapy, which is obviously the wrong way around, I think, but that's the sort of way she thinks about it.
Yeah, for sure.
You can hear the cat, I assume.
I can, yeah. But
yeah. Sorry about that. I'm at my mother's house and my mother has a cat, and the cat is...
Look, it's not a problem. I mean, honestly, all sorts of things crop up that you don't realize when you do these things, so don't worry about it.
Let's prove we're professionals and crack on.
And there's, of course, there's one really interesting aspect that you gave to Lucy, which is that she's a super recognizer.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Some people won't know what that is, but tell us.
Oh, sure. I think it's really interesting because I've created this dystopian world. It's future world. And so I've given her this power. And I think a lot of people will just assume that's part of the world building. And it's not a real thing. And it's something I've made up, but it's a really real right. thing. So there's a segment of the population that can essentially sort of instantly recall faces they've seen. And it's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum from face blindness.
Mm.
And so people who have this, and the term really is super recognizer, that's the term that's used, you know, pretty
and
much.
Police are starting to use these people, aren't they? But and security is, services, of course.
Which is absolutely amazing to me that Scotland Yard had a team years ago now of super recognizers. Mm. And their job, among other things, is to sort of look through huge batches of CCTV footage and spot a face. Because if they've seen it, if they've been given a face, and then they're told, just stare at this and tell me when you see the face, they can stare at footage for hours and then they see it. And it's just
like that. Yeah.
It's just like that. And it's an amazing thing. And I knew about it because at one point in my life, I'd seen a sort of test for it, and I'd done the test.
Right.
And it had popped back that I was to be pulled in for further testing for it. Because like I'd always had that thing where, I don't know if you have it, but where, you know, sometimes you meet people, but you recognize them from places before and you have to sort of pretend like you don't. Anyway, so I never went back in to get tested fully, but I knew about it. And so I thought it would be interesting because I think in this book, there's all sorts of faces thematically, like there are people who have survived these attacks and they're horribly scarred and they have to wear masks and things. And there's a lot of other sort of face related stuff. And so Lucy has that ability, but yeah, it's really, really real. And I just don't think, I'm surprised that it isn't better known, and I'm surprised it hasn't popped up in fiction before, at least as far as I can tell.
Yeah, no, you have a good point there. Talking more generally then about the novel and world building. I mean, every author is world building in a sense with whatever the novel is, but yours is very specific, obviously, because you've got this alternative London of a very near future. What was that like? Was it fun to do that? And then sort of, because then it leads you to have to imagine how people would react in this different kind of world.
Yeah, it was immensely fun to do. And some of the world building, so this, this was fun. So, you know, in terms of the details, I decided I needed to have a tremendous amount of little tiny details.
Mm.
And so what I did was I looked at my character, and she's really dealing with trauma, and she's dealing specifically with flashbacks. She constantly goes into flashbacks. And so, her future and her present and her past are just constantly swirling. And so what I decided to do was, in part, build a future out of the past. And so what I did was I went back to, because I love London and I love London's history. And I had all sorts of books and things about London in sort of the 17th century.
Right.
And so what I did was go back to old, so I've got a character who's this sort of crazed survivor blaming cult leader. And I based him on
Enoch.
Yeah, exactly. On a sort of eccentric divine who was living at that time. And so like all the sermons and stuff.
A doomsday preacher.
Back through. Yeah, exactly. And, the graffiti on the walls and stuff in my future is influenced by some of what was written on the walls back hundreds of years ago. And so it was really fun to do that.
It was fun to read that as well. If you know London, I don't live in London anymore, but I do know London. And so that was interesting. The Enoch Clapham story related to the preacher previously, but also I had the strongest sense of the 17th century because of all the things that happened in the 17th century, all the catastrophes, starting with a flood at the beginning of the century and working through the plague and the fire and everything.
Fire and
At Stepney, for instance, Stepney's a crucial part of the story. And it's also a plague pit. You know, it's where there's a major discovery of graves from the plague in back in the 17th century. And then you had some obvious ones like Jeff Hurst was a nice one thrown in there for more recent history for people to figure out. But obviously you love London. When you went there, you fell in love with the place, I take it.
Yep, I did. I'm immensely glad you caught that, by the way. I love it. I moved to London first in 2010. And I was pretty fresh from starting my career in law. And I just loved it. I mean, I guess I'd grown up reading, you know, not that every Agatha Christie is set in London, but sort of reading so many stories set in London. I loved Sherlock Holmes. And that little story I told you about was basically like a little tiny kid's ripoff of Sherlock Holmes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just, you know, it was sort of the city of my dreams. And I just love walking around London. I love reading about London. I love, you know, those little books that sometimes you see in bookshops in London that are like secret, you know, overlooked sites.
Yes, 100 different secret sites in London.
Oh, my God. I can't help it. I'm just such a sucker for those books.
I'm pretty sure, you know what, we probably passed each other on the street going in different directions with the same kind of guide.
I mean, and, you know, there's nothing to me that's more fun than like, oh, let's go explore this corner of the city and see, you know, all these people and see all these things and just absorb it. And but yeah, so like some of the different places that I decided to set scenes in the novel were sort of little kind of overlooked, like Cleopatra's Needle on the embankment. That's amazing to me that, you know, you're just walking down the embankment and you just pass casually this thousands and thousands of year old stone monument stuck there. And I guess whether it should be there is an open question.
Maybe that's another issue. Yeah.
You know, that's another issue, but the fact is it's there. And I just think it's so amazing that there's things just all over the place. You can just sort of wander into any street and see things that are old and see things that are new and see things that are just, you know, all ours. It's great. It's great.
Do you like London fiction as well?
Oh yeah. I mean, I do.
I know. Sorry. That's a sort of odd question.
No, not at all. I mean, I do. I think, I would say I don't just sort of exclusively look for something set in London when I'm
reading
books, but I love books that are set in London because to me, it's got that extra bit of, you know, I can walk over and see where this stuff is happening or happened. And in my head, I can really picture it. And so I do, I'm just bracing for the follow-up question of like, so what London fiction do you like best? And I'm trying to like, you know, figure out.
I just think there is a fiction like Dominic Nolan's recent book, Vine Street, which starts from the 1930s. And it just feels like a picture of London. You know, it puts those pictures of London in your head. And I just think as somebody, because I originally come from London, it's just something that, you know, you look out for that. And I suppose in a sense as well, knowing a lot about the place, you kind of know if somebody got it wrong too. Mm. And that would sort of stand out.
Yeah, and I think I tried really, really hard. I guess when I was writing this, I'd been in London for about 10 years. And
but you looked at it, you see, in a way that maybe some locals don't. As you just pointed out, how many thousands of people go past Cleopatra's Needle every day and don't give it a second glance? It's curious, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it, you know, and that would probably be me too if I wasn't such a, you know, hidden London book nerd. But I did have a character in this book who is Lucy's fiance, and he wants to be a London tour guide, and he's an Aussie. And, you know, Lucy's sort of born there, born in Bethnal Green, and, you know, just sort of blows off the stuff that he loves. And he's got these stacks of books and everything like that. And that's sort of a constant sort of thread in their relationship. And I just thought that was funny because that element of him is so clearly me.
It kind of puts you in the story. Yeah, I see.
That's kind of my, you know, those are my books sort of piled up on the ground that Lucy just sort of dismisses, which I thought was kind of funny.
It is. That's an interesting angle. Was it, you started this as a screenplay though, is that right?
I did start it as a screenplay. And I loved the idea of writing as a screenplay. And then I switched because I was going to start a writing course, and the writing course was built around a novel. And so I needed a novel.
Right.
And so I had this other, you know, novel that I was sort of working on, and I just didn't want to stop with Lucy. Like the character was just so deeply in my my brain that I just didn't want to stop. And so I thought, well, it would be interesting to try and do it as a novel. And I'm not sure, I don't know whether stylistically that carried through, because, you know, when you're writing for screen, you're always trying to keep everything on, or maybe not everybody does, but for me, it's so difficult to get everything into 90 yeah. pages or whatever it is. And, you know, I was looking at other screenplays and modeling, and, you know, everything's just so staccato and pacey, because you've got to squeeze everything in.
Yeah.
And so when I was writing this, I think some of that came through, because the style is so super choppy and staccato. And I think part of that came from it starting life as a screenplay.
Right. That's interesting, because two things drive the time. One is that staccato approach and drive the pace of the book. The other thing is time, the fact that it's all on such a tight time scale, and that also drives it that way as well. So that's interesting. After that initial idea then of the character, it's a very layered plot. We said that we won't talk too much about specifically what's in the plot, but murder, terrorists, the possible antidote, Lucy's personal story. There's an awful lot that feeds into this, the political background to all of that. How did that actually build up? Did you sort of envisage it this way, or was it a question of layering the story, if you like?
I think I had most of it in one go, more or less.
Right, right.
I think I knew very quickly how I wanted it to end. And so that drove a lot of the really plotty plot, I guess. You know, who was behind the murder and why. But the other thing that was even slightly before that was sort of how I wanted Lucy's character to sort of arc, and what I wanted her journey to be.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's really like, it's like an identity thriller in a way, where you've got this backstory of the character, and it sort of doesn't fully resolve until the plotty plot resolves.
Yes.
But I don't know. I mean, it sort of those things came to me at the same time. But I think, you know, the details around the world sort of is what I had to elaborate as I went. So some of the characters, like Clapham the preacher, that wasn't something that I instantly sort
right,
of came
okay,
up with.
Okay.
It was sort of like, okay, in this world, I knew why Lucy was sitting there, you know, injecting herself, and I knew there were terror attacks, and I knew, you know, who did what, but figuring out just a lot of the other bits and pieces sort of took some doing. I'd say I did it pretty fast. It was really probably 6 weeks or so of plotting, I think. And then it took about 6 months to write.
Right. Okay. That is pretty fast.
It was just steady. It was sort of writing, you know.
So I did wonder about the thing about the background, you know, because you've got this big, it's a big story. It's, you know, this apocalyptic story is very big. But at the same time, the whole focus is on the little story, which in a sense, or the personal story, which is Lucy's story. And you've got to keep those two balanced together. And it sounds like you had a clear line on the one, which is Lucy's story. And then it was a question of making the larger story fit with that, if you like.
Yeah. And I think it was a little bit tricky because originally I plotted it out as a screenplay. And so it had flashbacks throughout, because I thought of that as a very sort of filmic thing I could do. And then when I was like, okay, now I need to write this as a novel, you know, I have flashback chapters that,
yes, right, yes,
like,
yes,
you know, in each act, really they're like sort of a pinch in the middle of the act, and I wasn't sure if I could get away with it in a way, because I didn't want to pull away from the present day action. But it was just so one wrapped up in the other, sort of, you needed to understand her story in bits and pieces to understand why what she was going through was so difficult for her.
Yes, because absolutely.
So many of the challenges that she faces are in her own mind, in a way. There was a bit of, it all sort of drove, you know, she drove the plot and the plot drove her a bit. And so it was just a bit of juggling.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. How would you describe it? I just wondered, because it's a bit of social commentary as well, but there's an awful lot of talk about, is it a mystery? Is it sci-fi? You know, it's an alternative history or an alternative future. How would you describe the novel? Does it matter really? It's a book. No, and it's about character.
It's really funny because it's a debate that I had back. You know, it's my debut, so this was the book that I was going around, you know, that I was submitting to my agent, and then had the discussion with my agent exactly where does this sit? How do we describe it? And it's a thriller. I think of it honestly as an identity thriller, where it's all about the character sort of revealing what's happened to her. But I know that's not how anybody else would think about it. So I suppose dystopian police procedural is sort of how we've described it. Mm. Dystopian crime thriller. It's certainly crime. It's certainly about a cop.
Yeah.
And it's set in near future. So you could say it's like a sort of near future speculative crime thriller, but the word dystopian seems to, you know, make people focus in a way that sometimes near future speculative doesn't, I guess.
No, I suppose not. It is interesting though, because I think one of the things it's a police procedural in the sense that you've got a cop, but it's a very different kind of police procedural. But of course, the other thing you have is you have office politics. Yeah, I won't say more than that, because again, that's another element of the plot that feeds in. So we'll leave it at that. But that's the sort of thing that grounds it in that police procedural.
It's funny because I hadn't been thinking of it in those terms until I was talking about it, I think, with my editor. And Lucy is a cop, but I don't think of it as a sort of police procedural where
I know
there's a lot of focus on like how evidence is tagged. And no. I'm not, a former cop, and I've done plenty of research, but that wasn't really the focus.
No, it wasn't the point of the book. So yeah.
But it is, it has been described that way because it is about a cop chasing a murderer, and you do get into the other people in her, unit and things like that. So
I think the point is that mystery element of the book is absolutely fascinating, and it's going to pull people in for that as well as the other elements we're talking about. Looking at that dystopian thing then, is that because your worldview is a little dark or?
I think from a timing standpoint, it was really unusual because I started writing this in November 2019.
Right.
And the world was about to get really dark.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I finished writing it in maybe May 2022. And a lot happened in between then. And so I think it's funny because the plot was entirely baked. But, as I went, as the world around me started changing and shifting, I'm sure it didn't make me think lighter thoughts. Like I'm sure that.
No, right, right.
You know, it just got darker and darker in a way. Mm. But I don't know. I guess a funny thing about this is it's really dark in places, but I guess the question is, how does it end in a way? And without really wanting to give anything away, it's a question
It's open to interpretation.
I think
it's how you see. It's about human character, so let's leave it at that. It's about people. Is it interesting to you also then to look at that political aspect? I mean, there are elements of class issues in this book and things like that too.
Yeah, I think there's sort of all sorts of things about how we. And there's absolutely class elements, and there's sort of Lucy coming from where she comes from, and rubbing shoulders with people in her workplace, and struggling because of that. Mm. I didn't want to lean too heavily on that because. Obviously, just hearing my voice, I'm obviously such an outsider in a way. But I think there's a bit of that. And there's a bit of, people who are victims of tragedies, I think, in this. Because you know, Lucy's gone through this awful series of terror attacks, and she's one of the people in the city who's susceptible to this nerve agent. I didn't really get into it, but, you know, in the book, only about 10% of people really, really are susceptible to the nerve agent. Everybody else, it's like tear gas, but for 10% of the people, it's horrific. And she's one of those people. But as part of her backstory, she managed to sort of make it through the original attacks without getting, you know, heavily scarred.
Yes.
But all around her, there are these people who, you know, who are dealing with that and are struggling with a world that sort of on its surface wants to, you know, talk about it's the novel set on the eve of the sort of annual commemoration of the initial terror attacks. And so there are all these events going on around the city commemorating it. And yet the people who sort of are still there and suffering the most are still just being ignored and ostracized. And I'm not sure that is really meant to tie to any particular thing that's happened. You know, it's certainly not a direct commentary on anything in particular. It's just a sort of feeling that that does tend to happen over time.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to reflect that somehow.
Yeah, no, I think that makes an awful lot of sense. I know what I was going to say earlier. I was just going to say this is for us, the reader, not you, the writer. But I think that there's a possibility that people reading the book will identify with so much more because of what we have been through, or at least it will seem more immediate. I think that's a possibility anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I've had this discussion with a few people, and this certainly isn't a book that was written in response to the pandemic.
No, right.
At all. And I think there's a lot of differences, but I have been getting that, you know, that feedback and those comments quite a bit, which are, look, this is different from the pandemic. It's not a virus. It's a terror attack. It's a nerve agent.
Well, I wondered about that, you know, because it reminded me a little bit about the Russian attacks, the Skripal incident and things like that.
Which, incidentally, the Met used super recognizers to catch.
Right.
Sort of catch people, actually. But yeah, so it's sort of based on things that were very real worldy to me. But then obviously everything that happened with the pandemic resonated in a way I just couldn't have expected when I came up with the plot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I get a lot of, you know, this feels sort of obviously different, but chillingly close, because now we've seen what we've, you know, we've gone through this, and it's similar in a way enough to be scary. It's funny. I don't even know what to say about that other than, you know, it certainly wasn't intended to be, well, we've gone through something awful, so let me.
No, and let me say as well, I'm not blaming you for anything here either. No, but I know it can get that way though, can't it? A little bit like, oh, your only justification is because we're doing this. I'm not trying to get at that. No, certainly not.
Yeah, no, but it is odd that.
I just think in our unfortunate world, readers will. I mean, for instance, if you take the Spanish flu and what happened, or what they called the Spanish flu and what happened after the First World War, my grandmother suffered from it and survived. Mm-hmm. But barely survived, you know, and then had a long life afterwards. But it was touch and go at one point. But that's my only contact with that. And I knew roughly how many people died, or that we know 50 million, maybe more, did die. But it's an abstract. Mm-hmm. So all I'm saying in a sense is this, it's not such an abstract these days, you know, just to.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, the one thing that's for me as a writer, as opposed to, you know, readers, is I was going through that towards the tail end of it. And so, you know, there's fear and stuff in the book that was literally my fear as I was writing.
Right.
And some of the pace, I mean, it was always designed to be pacey, but I was writing really, really, really quickly at the end because I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know, you know, whatever. So it sort of seeps through maybe in a way. But it's funny.
Changing the subject slightly, well, not changing it really, but just developing on from that, because I think it's about what you draw from the past. And this particular issue is, you mentioned Enoch Clapham.
Yep.
And the religious angle is fascinating because taking that 17th century, as we discussed, you can imagine that they didn't understand these things happening to them. I mean, we at least have some sort of scientific explanation. My long-winded way of saying, tell us a little bit about the hand of God and how religion plays into the novel in that sense.
So So in the novel, there's a, I'm trying to do this without, I don't want to spoil any of it, but there's a...
yeah, I don't want Enoch's story or how he fits into the story, really. More that how you sort of reflect on the religious, how people go for religion in these kind of apocalyptic circumstances, because people want answers.
It is amazing, right? And it's amazing because the inspiration from this, as you say, was taken from a time where, you know, no one knew what was going on scientifically at all.
Right.
You know, and so many people turn to religion because what else do you turn to?
Mm.
And yet here in this book in 2029, it has that same appeal, despite living in a world where you've got, you know, scientists running around telling you exactly what's happening with this nerve agent. And, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I suppose for me, Clapham just represents the worst bits of religion, the bits that...
that seem to offer this easy answer.
An easy answer, and often that easy answer leads to sort of scapegoating and sort of othering people, and you know where it starts to feel like it's a, you know, a sport team fan thing, where it's sort of like, you know, this is us and there's everybody else, and it's not, it's certainly not meant as a reflection on religion as a whole at all. It's just that one bit of it, the sort of worst bit of it, that's sort of lurking and that can creep out, and that does appeal to some people. I think so.
Yeah, no, that, again, that makes an awful lot of sense. And as I said, well, people, I think, will get an idea now of how layered we're talking about this book being, you know, that how much of a background there is to this story. When it comes to style, you've got a noirish style here. Was that sort of natural? I mean, it's a dark story, so you can hardly tell it in sing-song verse, but
is I that think you? So. It wasn't me saying, okay, I'm going to intentionally affect an noir style. It's a debut, so it's probably a bit more of just what came naturally to me, I think.
Right.
Fair but enough. A lot of it was just really driven by the darkness of the story.
Mm.
I mean, just the title, like it's not, you know, coming in, it's going to be pretty dark.
Yeah, for sure.
And I enjoy noir, but it was sort of character driven. Like I wrote in that way, partially because I'd been doing that for the screenplay. And part of that was because I think that's how Lucy's head works. Even the bits that aren't, you know, dialogue or even internal monologue, just all of the words on the page, I wanted to sort of reflect her. And so a lot of it's me trying to be really close third person and be really choppy, because in her head, that's just how she is. She's super choppy and punchy. She's literally punchy. She's a boxer. And so I just wanted it to be sort of punchy because that's how I thought of the character.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense again, because we do see most of the novel through her eyes. You know, we're with her really closely the whole time.
Yeah. And I thought, that was a thing that I was sort of had to go rethink through. Because as a screenplay, you could easily have chunks of story, other points of view, scenes that Lucy isn't present.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
All that sort of stuff. And then I decided before I started writing that I didn't want any other points of view. I didn't want a chapter from the perspective of like the mysterious bad guy. I didn't want a chapter from anybody else's perspective. I wanted the entire thing to be as close to Lucy as possible. And every single word I put was really just an effort to try and have the reader feel like they were close to Lucy.
Yeah. And it's a much more immediate story for that. Any chance of film rights or something for this?
So I think my agent who is wonderful is out working on that right now, actually.
Great.
And I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it someday.
It'd be interesting, wouldn't it, that it started as a screenplay, if it actually wound up that way after the novel. But it's perfect for the screen as well.
We're doing a sort of, you know, blog tour right now, and that comment comes up over and over again. And
right.
I just think it's funny because it really is where it came from. And I just love to see it wind up that way. But it is so different in terms of, you know, I'm so happy I did write it as a novel because my favorite bits are Lucy's thoughts. And that's the thing you don't get.
Yeah. Very, very difficult to get that in a character on the screen. Of course it is. Yeah. But it does also indicate people see the pictures, you know, so your novel must have struck them in that way that they can get into this world and that they want to see it on the screen as well. So
I think a lot of it was, well, thank you. I think a lot of it was, you know, as I was plotting as a screenplay, searching for really visually arresting scenes and spots and things that happen. And then when it got translated into a novel, those things were there. And so it was really just a question of whether I could keep those images and put them in people's brains through words instead of pictures. But it was fun to do anyway.
Yeah, no, it's great. Always an odd question, but you are moving on, of course, because you have already finished this book. We're getting it now for the first time as readers. What are you working on now then?
Working on a sequel.
Right, great. Ah.
And
you're not going to tell us anything about that, are you?
I'm not going to. I don't want to tell you anything about that at all. Or who's in it or in what way, other than it's set in the same world.
Okay, fair enough.
So I'm doing that. And I've been working on two screenplays with a co-writer.
All right.
So that's been, we're developing those and that's been fun too. And they're totally different. They're not crime at all.
Oh, right. Okay. And again, you're not going to tell us anything about that, are you?
Well, I can. It's just, you know, they're two comedy dramas. And, you know, I think it will be of, you know, it may not be crimey enough, but it is something I'm working on. So,
oh, well, good luck with that anyway.
Thank you.
One last thing then. How about a recommendation?
Oh, boy. Okay.
Something that struck you in the sort of the research or your build up to the book, or something you've just read that you thought, you know what, people should know about this one.
Here's a book that I absolutely love, which is crime, but extremely different from my book.
There's
a book called The Adventures of Isabel by Candace Jane Dorsey. She's Canadian and it's phenomenal. I loved it. It's almost sort of comedy crime. A nameless, downsized social worker is the hero. And I loved it for the voice. It was one of those books.
Right.
It was like, I loved it like I love Douglas Adams or something, where you just sort of dip in because you just love the voice so much. I can't get over how much I love that book. So there's that. But it's, you know, it's obviously it's very far from being a dystopian noir.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I did genuinely love it. And then another book I'm reading right now is Five Minds by Guy Morpus.
Ah, yeah,
I
right.
I've read that. But I think it's just come out in paperback. But that's really good. And that is sort of set in the future and it's crime. So maybe that's a bit closer.
A bit closer. Well, anyway, what I'll do is I'll put some of those in the program notes so that people can see for themselves if they want to pick up on that. Jack, that's been great. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. It's been absolutely a pleasure. And I'm glad the cat calmed down.
Well, thank you, Jack, for a really fascinating insight into the world of London Black. London in Black is available now from Pushkin Press, and you can order a copy through bookshop.org on the program page if you follow the link. I'll be back with another interview very shortly. In fact, it'll be our very own Victoria Selman, chatting about her new novel, which is out on the 7th of July, Truly Darkly Deeply. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and bye.